President Trump suggested Wednesday that trade talks with China can wait until tensions in Hong Kong have eased. Writing on Twitter, Mr. Trump wrote, "Of course, China wants to make a deal. Let them work humanely with Hong Kong first." Trump also praised Chinese President Xi Jinping, calling him a great leader and saying he could quickly resolve the unrest in Hong Kong if he wanted to. Meanwhile, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton told VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren that China should show restraint in handling of its protest in Hong Kong.
They remember the picture of the man standing in front of the line of tanks. They remember the statue of Lady Liberty. They remember voices of the Chinese people asking for freedom and democracy. And they remember the repression of the Chinese government in 1989. It would be a big mistake to create a new memory like that in Hong Kong.
The demonstrations are against what many Hong Kong residents see as an increasing erosion of the freedoms they were promised in 1997 when Communist Party ruled mainland China took over what had been a British colony. At least one gunman opened fire on police Wednesday as they were serving a warrant in a Philadelphia neighborhood, wounding six officers and triggering a standoff that extended into the evening. The Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross says none of the officers' injuries are life-threatening. He says two officers were pinned down by the shooting and were freed by the SWAT team.
Absolutely remarkable the way they did it, to watch that unfold and to do so in large part without him being aware, or at least we don't think he was aware. I mean, and so their bravery, as well as the bravery of every other officer that, you know, took fire today, because they took fire today as well. You know, just about everybody at that scene did at some point in time.
Police say the two officers who were trapped inside the barricaded house had been freed. This is VOA News. Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan warned Wednesday rival India is planning a major cross-border military attack to divert world attention from its recent crippling crackdown in its part of the disputed Kashmir region. Khan issued the warning Wednesday in a nationally televised address in connection with Pakistan's Independence Day celebrations. It came more than a week after New Delhi abruptly dissolved the semi-autonomous constitutional status for an Indian-administered section of the Muslim-majority Himalayan region. The Indian move was accompanied with the deployment of tens of thousands of additional troops to the region, a communication blackout, and the house arrest of hundreds of Kashmiri political leaders to quell widespread violent reaction. At least six Somali government soldiers and a cameraman were killed, 13 others injured Wednesday, when al-Shabaab militants attacked a military base near the capital, according to officials. The officials say back-to-back vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices hit the base in one town that's 70 kilometers south of Mogadishu. Militants then attacked the base from two sides, exchanging gunfire with government forces before they were overpowered and pushed back. Al-Shabaab, which claimed responsibility for the attack, said it killed at least 50 government soldiers. Security sources told VOA Somali that government forces suffered six fatalities. The governor of one region told VOA Somali that a cameraman working with the Somali National Army was also killed. Said 23 militants were killed by the government forces. A woman who says that she was raped by Jeffrey Epstein when she was a teenager is now suing his estate and three of his associates. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
The lawsuit is the first step, says accuser Jennifer Arose, to get her life back.
They robbed me of my youth, my identity, my innocence, and my self-worth. For too long, they escaped accountability. I am here today because I intend to change that.
That lawsuit is against Epstein's former girlfriend and three unnamed members of his staff. It's one of many lawsuits expected to be filed after a new state law called the Child Victims Act adjusted the statute of limitations. I'm Shelley Adler.
Mexico's Supreme Court ordered the health ministry on Wednesday to issue regulation within 6 months on medical marijuana use, saying that its failure to do so after legislation in 2017 had put rights at risk for patients, including children. The court made the decision as part of its ruling in favor of a child who needed medication derived from a cannabis substance, THC, to treat epilepsy. The health ministry had been instructed to update its guidelines within half a year following the June 2017 reform to legalize marijuana for medical and scientific needs. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UNICEF says violence and abuses against children are on the rise in Mali.
The recruitment and use of children in armed groups has doubled, with 99 cases in 2019 against 47 over the same period in 2018.
The United States sanctions the former Director General of Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Services. A spokesman for Cameroon separatists says his 80-year-old mother has been abducted by the government. Liberia's Elections Commission orders a re-voting in the recent representative by-election. And Uganda says online publishers must register with the government.
We see these undertones are very political, and the person who's seeking to stay in power longer is older, and the population which is going to vote will be much younger for the first time, and they are on the internet, and they are visibly anti the status quo.
Rosebel Kagumiri is a Uganda blogger, and Botswana battles an influx of Zimbabwean illegal immigrants. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. Violence and human rights abuses against children in Mali are skyrocketing, according to the United Nations Children's Fund. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Never entirely stable since a 2012 coup, Mali is now experiencing new unrest marked by food shortages and intercommunal clashes. Children in Mali are among the biggest victims of the havoc being perpetrated by armed groups inside the beleaguered country, says UNICEF. The UN agency says more than 150 children were killed in conflict in the first half of this year, compared with 77 in all of 2018. It says three times as many children were injured in attacks this year than last. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says some children are being used as child soldiers.
The recruitment and use of children in armed groups has doubled, with 99 cases in 2019 against 47 over the same period in 2018. These are figures that the United Nations has verified, and the true figures are without doubt higher.
UN agencies report widespread human rights violations in Mali's central regions, including summary executions, disappearances, torture, and arbitrary arrests. Mercado says children are unable to access basic services because of the violence. More than 70,000 children have not received a vaccine that prevents meningitis and pneumonia, among other diseases. And more than 250,000 are losing out on an education because of closed schools, mostly in the central Mopti region. She tells VOA that UNICEF is doing what it can to help and to protect the children of Mali. But she says humanitarian workers have limited access to many areas of the country because of the fighting.
We take every opportunity, every lull in the fighting, every chance we can to reach children in need. Obviously, we need, in order to reach children in need systematically, we need for the security and situation to improve. We need for the fighting to stop.
Mercado says many children are separated from their families and suffer from sexual abuse and psychological trauma. She says UNICEF tries to help by providing medical and psychosocial care to tens of thousands of conflict-affected boys and girls. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States Wednesday imposed a visa ban on the former Director General of Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Services for his involvement in gross human rights violations. Salah Abdallah Mohamed Mohamed Saleh, also known as Salah Ghosh, is accused of torture during his tenure as head of the NISS. Joshua White is Director of Policy and Analysis at the Century, a Washington-based investigative and policy group that follows the dirty money connected to African war criminals. He says the group urges the United States to also consider freezing the assets of Ghosh and any of his commercial collaborators who will be found to be complicit.
It's worth noting that while these are visa sanctions against Salah Ghosh and his family and not financial sanctions, I think it sends a clear message to members of the former regime that the United States is continuing to hold them accountable for human rights abuses and corruption that occurred under the former regime.
Which other Sudanese officials would your organization like to see sanctioned by the United States?
What we are hoping for is not just the individuals at the top, although certainly they should have their assets and their travel restricted as well, but the network of bankers and associates and middlemen who allow these individuals to continue to steal from the Sudanese people. In particular, someone like Hamedi, General Degallo, who a former number two rose up to be commander, is someone who we think is certainly deserving of sanctions based on his horrific human rights track record, but also under global Magnitsky sanctions, which is another tool that the United States has to freeze the assets of people involved in corruption and human rights abuse.
You mentioned the peace spoilers. There's an effort underway in Sudan for the formation of the transitional government. Are you pleased with the effort that is going on?
I think what we are looking to see and watching very carefully is the extent to which the civilian members of the Sovereign Council have an ability to make real systemic change and to hold accountable those in the previous regime who will continue to be in power. What we want to see is that, one, the agreement is allowed to take place as it has been written, but two, we want to see that it's not merely just a change of faces at the top, but rather systemic change that allows real accountability and real governance for the people of Sudan.
With regard to Salah Ghosh, are you interested in, say, a freeze on his assets or any of his collaborators?
Yes, absolutely. We think that is really the gold star in terms of what needs to happen by the United States, the European Union, and the African Union in order to really bring true accountability, but also leverage to ensure that these individuals don't continue to perpetuate this cycle of violence, don't continue to steal from state assets. And so what we're hoping to see is this visa ban against Salah Ghosh and his family members followed up by financial sanctions against the whole network of Salah Ghosh, in addition to him and his family, so that they can't enjoy the fruits of their spoils.
Joshua White is Director of Policy and Analysis at the Century, a Washington-based investigative and policy group that follows the dirty money connected to African war criminals. You're speaking with us from Washington, D.C. The National Elections Commission of Liberia, also known as NEC, has called for a rerun at 20 polling places in the July 29 House of Representatives by elections in the capital, Monrovia. Opposition candidate Telia Oyure had filed a complaint against the commission, citing several irregularities and fraud. After weeks of legal arguments, the commission ruled on Wednesday the ballots were tampered with during the tallying process at its headquarters. Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia.
The by-election, though a small part of Liberia's electoral process, was seen by some analysts as a test of the National Elections Commission's integrity. The commission, whose reputation has come under serious scrutiny, didn't take lightly the violations alleged by Ms. Yuri. Commissioner Mona Vey, who heard both sides of the argument, delivered a ruling that angered the ruling party but delighted opposition Kennedy Yuri.
Votes from the currently precincts have been compromised and that servos no longer fit the credibility status set by the NEC. We therefore mandate a rerun to be conducted at the 6th quarantine precinct by our responding National Elections Commission.
Responding to the verdict, Ms. Talia Yuri applauded the process and said the ruling was a partial remedy to her allegations of fraud.
The hearing officers at NEC did the honorable thing and honest thing by admitting to some of the irregularities and admitting to some of the acts. Well, they didn't admit to some of the acts of fraud, but we know that it was pervasive and it definitely pointed to fraud. And now they've ruled that we'll have a rerun in 6 precincts, which is not what we prayed for, but I can say that it's a partial remedy.
She said though she accepts the verdict, she would not go to the process that still has a fraudulent system in place.
We're going to be asking for the data center director to step down in the midst of all of this. They need to make the requisite adjustments on the voter rolls, clear some of the discrepancies that we found from the 2017-2018 rule, and then we can say that we're going into a process that will be free and fair.
Meanwhile, the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change says it is not happy with the Elections Commission's ruling. CDC Chairman Moma Malu said the verdict shows that the NEC was partial in handling the electoral dispute.
When it comes to the CDC candidate, what was he primarily? The total serials, the investigating, the reduced votes, the quarantine to the polling centers, and we are hearing now that they are about to announce a rerun at this polling center. This is unacceptable. They want to plunge this country into chaos. They are determined to disrupt democratic governance because they don't like the president in power.
The elections have been tense with clashes between supporters of both the ruling party and the opposition. According to Ms. Zure, her supporters were not protected by the Liberia National Police.
All of the incidents that have happened with our camp being attacked and the police just standing by and not even doing anything to help our supporters. They were stoned. 26 people were injured the first time. Yesterday, the same thing happened. Women are in the hospital. And you do not hear the Election Commission speaking out against it. You do not hear the government condemning it, the justice minister stepping in when there are clear pictures and clear evidence.
Since 2005, Masurado County has been a stronghold of the ruling CDC with more seats in the legislature than any other party. But for now, it seems support for the ruling CDC is gradually slipping following the victory of opposition senatorial candidate Ibrahim Darius Dillon in the July 29 senatorial by-election. Moses Gazel, VOA News, Monrovia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 15th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. The spokesman for Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonian separatist is calling on what he calls French Cameroon to free his 80-year-old mother, Mama Grace Mafouantem, who he said was abducted 2 weeks ago, along with her daughter. VOA was unable to reach Cameroon authorities for comment. Chris Anu says Cameroon authorities denied family lawyers permission to see his mother, who he said is being held at the notorious State Secretariat for Defense. He says his mother is diabetic and hypertensive. Anu, who says his younger brother is a commander in the separatist movement, says it would be wishful thinking if Cameroon authorities think that they can hold his mother to force the separatists to end their struggle.
As we speak, my mother and my sister are still in health incommunicado in a gendarmerie facility they call SED in Yaoundé. They were picked up, it's going to 2 weeks now, and lawyers have done everything to have access to them, but colonial authorities in Yaoundé have refused having any lawyer to have access to them. Right now, my mother has not been seen, and she's diabetic. She's also hypertensive. She was only 3 days from hospitalization when they were picked up. And we learned in there they are being tortured. We are talking about a woman of 80 years old.
When you say the gendarmes have denied permission, have they admitted that they abducted or taken your mother?
They admitted taking them. The lawyers visited them the following day that they were picked up. The gendarmes asked them that only a court can give them permission to see my mother and my sister. Being that it was a weekend, the lawyers went back. Last Monday, they were in court to get that piece of document from the court. They got it, went back to that detention facility, and again, they were not allowed to see my mother. And as we speak, Thursday will make it exactly 2 weeks that they were picked up and nobody has seen them.
Chris, you are spokesperson for the Ambazonian, and as far as I know, you must have said that you have a brother who's a commander of the separatists. So, I mean, if it's true now that the government soldiers took your mother, can you understand from a war perspective why they would take her?
No, I can't understand because I don't understand how you pick up an 80-year-old mother for the sins of his children. It doesn't happen that way. In normal life, children pay for the sins of their parents, not parents paying for the sins of their children. And so it is unthinkable that they would pick up an 80-year-old mother because of the children's involvement in the struggle for the independence of their own country. We have made it very clear we are not going to negotiate with the Republic of Cameroon. They already have over 5,000 Ambazonians in their dongeons in Yaounde, Douala, and all other places, Boya. And I have made it very clear, my mother, my sister, they're not any different from these other Ambazonians. If they think that they are holding them so we can give up or surrender, or Kimasha can surrender, well, they have picked the wrong people. It is not going to happen. The only thing that will satisfy us is a free and independent Southern Cameroon.
So is it fair to say that you are willing to sacrifice your mother for the independence of Ambazonia?
I am not willing to sacrifice my mother. Nobody wants to do that. The point I am making is that they have no legal standing to even have her in their custody. And because it is illegal what they are doing, let them correct their illegality by freeing them unconditionally.
The Cameroon government can also say that the Ambazonians have also done the same thing, targeted innocent civilians.
No, the Ambazonians haven't targeted innocent civilians. Ambazonians do not have jails where they keep innocent civilians. Ambazonians do not have mass graves where they bury innocent civilians. Ambazonians do not have troops on the streets of French Cameroon where they randomly shoot to kill innocent civilians. We do not. They are the state. We are freedom fighters.
Chris, thank you very much again. We are always very happy to speak with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Chris Anu is Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Uganda's Communication Commission announced last week that all commercial online publishers must register with the government. The commission says their publishers have to be watched to ensure that they are posting what it calls appropriate content. Ugandan social media influencers and news organizations say the requirement is a step towards limiting freedom of speech and the press. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Bettina Tumhai says non-online as the proud farmer posts videos promoting farming and giving farmers advice on how to improve their incomes. Tumhai says has 17,000 followers, a small number in a country of 43 million people. But because she's doing well enough to make money off the posts, officials say online publishers like her must now register so their content can be observed and regulated. Tumhaise says she would rather be taxed than monitored.
If I'm posting and I'm getting 300 per post that I get, and I'm sure that you know this is what I'm getting, tell me, give me 1%, and I'll give it to you. But don't come hiding under registration when in actual sense you have your ways, that you have something else that you're trying to promote.
Uganda's Communications Commission says too much online content contains misinformation that can incite the public. Forcing those with influence to register, even those already licensed, will make them mindful of what they post, says UCC spokesman Ibrahim Bossa.
These are people who are online radios, online television, online publishers, but we're also saying that we have equally people who would be using online platforms like blogs, like Facebook, still for commercial purposes, and they earn money from it, and they actually disseminate information to wide audiences. The content they put out there is of importance, so we say they should register.
But bloggers like Rosbel Kagumire note that Uganda already has laws to regulate online communication and says the registration requirement is worrying.
We see these undertones are very political and very really rooted in the fact that Uganda is a very young country, and the person who's seeking to stay in power longer is older, and the population which is going to vote will be much younger for the first time, and they are on the internet and they are visibly anti the status quo.
Uganda last year instituted a social media tax that many online publishers saw as a government effort to curb free speech. Nation Media Group editor Charles Bichache says expanding the registration raises some concerns about press freedom, but is still in line with the law.
UCC is testing out how much it can go in terms of holding the media. And I think as media, we need to be able to fight back, but within the law.
While authorities can easily track whether Uganda's media outlets have registered, it's not yet clear how well they will trace individuals like bloggers and what enforcement will be used to ensure compliance. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Botswana is battling an influx of illegal immigrants from Zimbabwe as the Zimbabwean government struggles to overcome a deep economic crisis. But authorities in Botswana appear to be losing the battle as those who are deported are soon back in the country. Kundise Dube reports from Gaborone.
Prosper Kandanamo and Thomas Kundani left Zimbabwe and entered Botswana illegally because of the moribund economy in their homeland.
I came into Botswana because back to my home in Zim, there are no job opportunities.
The two are among the many illegal immigrants from Zimbabwe who line the streets of Gaborone looking for odd jobs. But they are an unwelcome sight for authorities and subject to frequent police raids. The number of Zimbabweans arrested and deported in Botswana rose from 22,000 in 2015 to nearly 29,000 in 2018. Kandi Namo, an accountant, says they are often caught.
It's better for you to be caught by the police at the cells. They will give you food, they will give you transport to the border, they deport you, then you find your way back here than to go back to your Zim.
Kundani, a painter, says they would rather risk arrest than return to face hardship in Zimbabwe.
You just have to come back. The situation here, it's a bit difficult. It's difficult for us, but as compared for the situation in Zimbabwe, it's more worse.
Botswana citizens like Mohamed Mkhashane say illegal immigrants contribute to rising crime and are demanding a solution.
Now turn back today, tomorrow they're here, because there's nothing to hide. There's nothing they can put them to stay back where you are taking them. Always they will come here because they know that there's a fruit here where they can enjoy a day and they can be in plan for something.
Illegal immigration will persist as long as Zimbabwe's economic crisis is not addressed, says Gaborone-based analyst Lawrence Ogeditse.
For so long as economic and other opportunities are not quite there, people are going to move and you can't stop them from moving. It's not a nice thing to go through a border hunted with guns and all those things, but if you see people doing this, then it says to you that the cost of doing it is actually higher than the cost of staying.
Botswana spends about 100,000 a year deporting Zimbabwean illegal immigrants. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. At least 6 Somali government soldiers and a cameraman were killed and 13 others were injured on Wednesday when Al-Shabaab militants attacked a military base near the capital. Officials say back-to-back vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices hit the base in the town 70 kilometers south of the capital, Mogadishu. Militants then attack the base from two sides, exchanging gunfire with government forces before they were overpowered and pushed back. Al-Shabaab, which claimed responsibility for the attack, said it killed at least 50 government soldiers. Security sources told VOA Somali that government forces suffered 6 fatalities. The United States on Wednesday imposed a visa ban on the former director general of Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Services for his involvement in gross human rights violations. Salah Abdallah Mohamed Saleh, also known as Salah Ghosh, is accused of torture during his tenure as head of the NISS. Joshua White, director of policy and analysis at the Century, a Washington-based investigative and policy group that follows the dirty money connected with African criminals, says the group urges the United States to also consider freezing the assets of Ghosh and any of his commercial collaborators who will be found to be complicit. That's it for this Thursday, August 15 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show.
I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah.
Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.